I was interested in your history.
Sure.
Background. And the first thought that sprung to mind was, you know, were you planning on law school from the get-go?
No, I think like a lot of liberal arts people, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And the story I told you, actually, I probably was leaning more toward law school than getting a PhD in history. But when I saw Professor James Blaine Hedges at Brown, who I was close to, and to talk to him, he advised me to go to law school rather than get a PhD in history. So I was headed toward law school, not that I was dying to be a lawyer, but couldn't think of what else to do. It seemed interesting. Would pay the rent. So it was more accidental, whatever you call it. It wasn't very premeditated.
Was it accidental that you got led toward finance?
I worked for a New York law firm one summer, Chadburn Park, and then I worked for them after I got out of law school. Then I went in the Army, and I was working in their financial area. I didn't want to go back to New York, so I came to a Washington law firm in 1968, Hogan and Hartson, where I did financial work. So I was interested in finance. And I was there, I think, 2.5 years or so. Liked the people a lot. It was a very nice law firm. Did not love doing financial documents. And Dave Silver, who was then general counsel of the Institute, had my name from a mutual friend and approached me about the ICI job. The ICI then was very few people. This was in 1971. I think it was about 20 or 24 people. There was Dave and another lawyer. And when I checked around, I asked people, and different people I knew in Washington, everybody had very positive things to say about the mutual fund industry and even more about the Investment Company Institute. It had a reputation different than other associations in that it was more pro-regulation, more public-spirited, higher intellectual caliber, and so on. So people I spoke to, both in industry and government, spoke very highly of it. And of Bob Augenblick, who was the president, and Dave Silver, who was the general counsel.
Did you find that to be the case?
Yes. I was knocked over by it. I had not liked college very much. I had not liked law school. Law practice, I liked the people, not the work. And almost from the first day at the Institute, I was very impressed by it, by the intellectual caliber, by the integrity of the people there and in the fund industry.
How would you explain that?
I don't really know. I think, again, it's the individual people, but my impression is that the fund industry began in Boston by money managers who had a fiduciary, trustee kind of attitude toward things. And I think, and that has endured, and I think trade associations, like children reflect their parents, I think reflect their industries. And I think the people they chose to run their trade group and the culture they wanted reflected their own business culture. I mean, they were out to make money, but they were not, they seemed of a different breed than most people in commerce.
Did Augenblick come from?
No, Augenblick had been a lawyer, gone to Harvard Law School, Sullivan and Cromwell, his own law practice, and came to the Institute. He was a litigator, and he had come to the Institute in the early 60s. This was a bit of a digression, but for years, for 60 years or something like that, from 1936 on, the Institute's outside tax counsel was a fellow named Eddie Cohen. Cohen had begun, and he represented the industry even before the Institute was created. He had known Augenblick at Sullivan and Cromwell, so when the Institute in the early 60s was looking for a general counsel, he referred them to Bob Augenblick. So Augenblick was first general counsel, then president. Dave Silver had come from the SEC to the Institute. Yes, there are three. In fact, there are four in a row because Augenblick, general counsel, president, Silver, Fink. Now, Paul Stevens, the current president, I hired him as our general counsel in the mid-90s. He left for other things, but again, he was chosen. So we've had four former general counsel as president. Yeah.
Let's move back before you became general counsel. Talk about what you did. What was your day-to-day when you came to the ICI?
Oh, boy, it is hard to remember, but it was varied. In 1970, for the first time in 30 years since the Investment Company Act of 1940, Congress had enacted new mutual fund legislation, the 1970 amendments to the Investment Company Act. And there were a number of new provisions added that required rulemaking by the SEC to be implemented. And at that point, to show you how good relations were, the SEC would propose some and we would comment. So my job was preparing the industry's comment letters on that. But in addition, the SEC asked us to give them the original drafts of several rules. So two of the very first things I worked on were drafting the rule that requires funds to have fidelity bonds, Rule 17G1, and another section that requires funds to have codes of ethics dealing with personal investing by their personnel, 17J1. So I actually sat down with help of people in the industry and outside counsel and drafted rules. So part of it, a chunk of my responsibility, was SEC regulation. We also did not have a tax attorney. There are only three attorneys, Dave Silver, Barbara Santos, and myself. I became our de facto tax attorney, which is a bit frightening. There's a whole system of mutual fund tax. It has its own body of law called Subchapter M of the Internal Revenue Code. It's like a mini Investment Company Act. So I was the good fellow on the tax. Third, Congress had begun to consider pension legislation, which became the 1974 Pension Reform Act, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act of 1974, ERISA. And I was the ERISA lawyer. Very few people in the industry knew anything about retirement plans. I had a committee of three people in the industry, and we cobbled together a program, a 5 or 6 part program of things we wanted in ERISA, and we got all of them. So I was an ERISA lawyer. So it was a whole, there were only Dave and me and Barbara Santos, so everybody got into everything. But it was very broad, a lot of different things.
On the ERISA work, did you work with Senator Javits's?
Yes, with his staff, if I can remember their names anymore. Mike Gordon. We also worked, Senator Williams, I think, was the majority. I think the Democrats had the Senate, so Senator Williams' staff. Steve Paradise, Steve Sacker, and the House side.
What was the process like?
Well, it was much simpler in those days. Now, one thing to remember, I see you could spend years on this, ERISA was largely aimed at one problem. That was defined benefit plans. These plans were large corporations promised their employees when they retired. There had been bankruptcies in the late 60s. Studebaker had gone bankrupt, and it was kind of a scandal that these plans did not pay what they promised, were not funded, didn't invest. So 95% of the attention in Congress was on addressing defined benefit plans. Those plans were of no interest to the mutual fund industry. We didn't fund defined benefit plans. We had a tiny toe in the water on small employer-defined contribution plans, like KEO plans. So through my own efforts, people in the industry, I put together a 5 or 6 part program all dealing with defined contribution plans. And I would come in the office at 7 and write testimony till 9 and then go up. And we had no lobbyists on our staff. So I was the client, the lawyer, and the lobbyist. I mean, this is all under Dave Silver and Bob Agovic's supervision, but it was fascinating because there was no division of labor, which is a terrible problem because trying to explain some intricate pension provision to a lobbyist is difficult. So I did all three, and it was extremely successful. It formed the basis for what later became the fund industry's success in the individual retirement account market and the 401k market. This was kind of the underpinning. So it was very interesting, and there are provisions in ERISA. There's one provision, God, I can't remember the number of it, that was often referred to as the Matt Fink provision. It was that well known. But it was fascinating because I did all three. There was no opposition to us because we were the only people. I was the only person up there on defined contribution and IRAs. So it was fairly easy sledding from that point of view. But
what was the industry like? Who were the big players that you were seeing?
The industry, when I joined, had about $50 billion in assets. That soon fell to about $32 billion because we had a bad market in the early 70s. I'd have to go look, but the principal players I remember were Jack Barnard of Massachusetts Investors Trust. That was the first mutual fund. John Hare at a firm called Fundamental Investors, I think. I may have the wrong name. And Jack Bogle, who then was at Wellington. Those were three of the most involved, influential members on big issues. There were a group of the attorneys, because the Institute's key contact then were the top people, like I just named, and since we were mostly a legal, legislative, regulatory group, the attorneys, the general counsels were critical. And there were a series of them about my age, or I guess some older, who were quite active. And I'm probably going to miss a lot of them, but Henry Hopkins at T. Rowe Price, Arnie Scott at at Mass Financial Services, the name had become, Dick Riley at Fidelity Group. So those were the principal people. In the ERISA area, there was almost no one, because nobody... funds were not in the business very much. And there was kind of a tag team of people who knew things.
So there wasn't a lot of defined benefit expertise?
Well, there wasn't any defined. We were not defined benefit people. Okay. We had defined, and the funds had not really, defined contribution funds were very small then. Funds had a tiny part of that, but no real heavy expertise. Not much. There was some, but not. Well, you'd have to look at provision by provision. First of all, I'll just give you three examples. There is a section in the code called 403B that permits universities and charities to have something that looks like 401k plans for their employees. You can actually reduce your salary and contribute, and the school system can contribute. But since it went in the code, whatever year it went in, you could only use it to buy insurance annuities. It had been written, I think, for TIA CREF. It had been designed for their funding for college professors. And we had a provision that in lieu of using buy insurance annuities, you could do mutual funds. So in that market, mutual funds had never been in that market before. That was one example. Another example was in 1962 or so. At that point, all you had were corporate retirement plans. Self-employed people could not have plans. A law named after Congressman Keogh went in that doctors, lawyers, etc. could contribute, take a deduction, I think $2,500 a year. Mutual funds were very big. I think we were 40% of the Keogh market. But it was kind of a forerunner of 401k, but most Keogh plans were small. We tend to think of these big law firms or medical practices. That time, I think the average Keogh plan had 1.5 lives, had the doctor and his nurse or the lawyer and his secretary. And there we got what I would call technical provisions. One provision increased the amount you could contribute to Keogh plans. It was that sort of thing. So it was an expansion and a perfection of Keogh plans. Those were the kind of things we did.
I guess there were some amendments in 75 that came in?
This is Dave Silver, and this is in the securities law, not ERISA. This is Dave Silver's expertise, but I'll tell you what I can remember, which is going to be imperfect. What we would often do, there were three of us, and then Barbara Santos left for a long time. There were two of us. So Dave and I would take different, or Bob Agenbuck, we would take different projects and just do them. What had happened, there had been a court decision, something against Lazard,
Judge Friendly,
that said that, in effect, an advisor could not sell his business for a profit. It was a sale of a fiduciary office. Now, it had unique facts and so on, but it was a problem. And that meant nobody in the industry could ever transfer. And so Dave, and I was there, but I didn't do very much on it. Dave, I guess working with members and outside counsel, came up with a legislative solution to the problem and worked and got the SEC's agreement. And I think in 75 there was major securities legislation, not mutual fund legislation. And my recollection is this got added as a provision to that securities legislation, allowing a transfer if certain conditions were met.
That would seem like a fairly smart thing to do if you're trying to make the mutual fund industry attractive to investors.
Well, again, that's not attractive to you and me. That's to the people who own the business. Yeah, but it would stultify the business. People wouldn't have an incentive to build up a business if they couldn't liquidate.
Right.
It was kind of an odd thing.
Well, and the backdrop to this is 75.
Right.
The backdrop to this is the net redemption situation.
Yes, and that, I think, you probably have the numbers from somebody, but I believe just about the time I joined, we went into net redemptions for something like 12 straight years. I think like 140 months, maybe 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, I think it was in the late
70s
somewhere.
I think that's probably right. Yeah. But it went on a long time, at least a decade. Now, I didn't know what it meant because I came in and that was reality. So the fact that people were selling apples on street corners didn't seem to me normative. But it was a long, bad period.
Well, I guess my sense of it would be there must have been some amount of demoralization or some wondering what we can do to get out of this situation.
You know, it's hard, again, the Institute... Well, you represent an industry to some degree is cut off from it. We are Washington think tank, eggheads, lobbyists, whatever term you want. And there's a difference between that and being in the industry, being at Fidelity or MIT or Dreyfus. It's a different feeling. So I think there was demoralization. This is looking back 30 years, so it's hard to get, I hope I don't make it up now. But I think there also was a belief that the mutual fund was a terrific product and that somehow we would come out of this. I think that never, I don't remember anybody despairing or quitting. I don't think many people dropped out of the business, either firms or individuals. That was a very small industry then. I'll tell you what, sort of interrupt you. About in 1974 or 5, it's the maid. Hey, Mary. Is it open? Hey, Mary. Believe it or not, I'm being interviewed. Believe it or not. How you doing? This is Ken. How you doing, Mary? We had it with the Institute. Always had its annual membership meeting. Always has it here in Washington D.C. We had it at the Shoreham Hotel. The first day, let's say, the session ended at 4 o'clock, and the cocktail party was until 6, and people had no place to go. Half the room cleared out, the big room. The industry was so small, I said to people in the room, gee, my wife and I have an apartment 3 blocks from here. Let's go over there. And we will cross Connecticut Avenue. Somebody bought a case of beer, and somebody bought a case of soda. My wife and I had a moderate-sized two-bedroom apartment at 21st and Calorama, 19th and Calorama, and we all went up, and all of us fit in the apartment. Easily. So may have been 40 people, which that was half of the executives, lawyers, marketing people in the fund industry in 74, 75. Yeah.
77
Right.
And I would guess at this point you're working, sounds like all along you're working very closely with Dave.
Oh, yes. Yep.
Can you tell me a little bit about what you saw, that he brought to the ICI?
Okay. First of all, Dave was very bright and very tough. Tough, rigorous. And he was, I don't know if the word is fearless. I used to say to Dave, he would throw a 90-yard pass on first down. Dave was a very good strategist, Machiavellian, whatever you want to call it, but was a superior strategist, dealing with the SEC, dealing with the Hill. I think that's what he brought. He also, like Augenblick and both of them, could the ethical, moral behavior was very strong. Of never do anything you don't want to see in the New York Times tomorrow, look at the long view, that sort of stuff. But he was imaginative. Dave was able to think out, whatever the trite phrase is, think outside the box. I'll give you one example. Because of the securities laws said that a company that's issuing stock in the business of issuing securities cannot advertise. Can advertise its product, but not its securities, because you have an offering going on. Since mutual funds are offering every day, that meant they couldn't advertise, basically. The SEC liberalized a few rules called the Tombstone Rule, blah, blah, blah. But it couldn't do much. You could not say, T. Rowe Price could not run an ad tomorrow saying, you ought to think about our XYZ fund. It was up 45% last year. It was illegal. And Dave came to me one day and said, have I been reading, and I was very busy, have I been reading the Supreme Court cases on the First Amendment? I said, Dave, I am very busy here. He said, have you read the? I said, no, I saw the headline in the paper. But he said, well, you know, they hold up that the commercial speech is protected. And he said, how can the SEC prevent mutual funds from advertising if it's not fraudulent? And I said, Dave, the securities laws don't allow it. Dave said, which do you think has precedence, the First Amendment or the securities laws? So Dave was able to think of stuff, something very disconnected. I don't think anybody else in the world ever would have thought of that. Outside the box, tough. They would want to do something, and he would go through barriers to do it. Those were and ethical. I think those would be the three things I would say. Yeah.
We're on advertising. And yeah. That's one down the list.
Yeah.
Let's get to that. When you came in, you could have a Tombstone ad.
Yes. And a very limited Tombstone ad. And over time, one of the things I did work on, I can't remember it all, was liberalizing the Tombstone ad. And at first, all you could put is T. Rowe Price, Common Stock, 100 Pratt Street, Baltimore. The SEC adopted, my recollection is, a special Tombstone rule for mutual funds that would let you go further. That's what I worked on. But they always drew the line at performance. You could not put past performance in. And then this First Amendment argument that Dave made, other things I can't remember, the SEC very imaginatively, and I think the SEC thought of this, not the ICI, came out with a rule that is now the rule, I think it's Rule 482, though my probably wrong, that lets funds, they call it a mini prospectus, so you have prospectus liability, but you can advertise past performance. And what that did, it has not been recognized. That really helped the no-load funds. Before that time, when I joined the Institute, 95% of the sales were load fund sales. 8.5% front-end sales loads. No-load funds were almost non-existent. T. Rowe Price Growth Fund was the only well-known no-load fund. And they were always inhibited because they had no easy way to reach investors. If you were Scudder or T. Rowe Price, you couldn't advertise, so how were you going to, you know what I mean, salesman, how could you? This performance advertising really opened that up, and nobody's ever written about that, but I'm convinced it had huge benefits to investors. And that was the thing the SEC thought of, though it's hard to say, it's probably chicken and egg. If we were to go trace the history of the advertising rules, sometimes you'll find it's the Institute leading, sometimes the SEC. Here the SEC took the ball over the goal line.
Seems like advertising
Oh, constantly. Yeah. So there's only about 10 issues, and they always the same ones keep coming up. Yeah. Yeah.
I did notice that one seemed to.
Yes. Over. Yes.
There's something that was called the omitting perspective.
Yeah. That was yes. That was well. That was different. I think that wasn't. Maybe I'm wrong. Well, maybe this was the omitting perspective. Maybe this advertising rule was. I can't. The terminology I can't remember anymore now. Yeah. I think that's what it was. So you could take your 30-page prospectus, pick four key things, run this ad. Yeah.
Did that? Was there a point at which all that went away and things were opened up?
No, it's still the same way. There still are SEC advertising rules, which I couldn't cite anymore. But that, for example, if you give performance, you have to give your average of your last, I think it's 3, 5, and 10 years. So there are requirements, which there should be. I think the NASD does. Because the NASD, while it regulates brokers in the mutual fund area, it regulates sales of mutual funds. That's how it, or offerings of mutual funds, yeah.
Well, the thing I skipped over.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to get a sense of your interactions with the SEC.
Okay. I think it went through, it has, first of all, going way back. The institute was created, for years, the industry was very badly split between closed-end funds, who were the dominant form, and mutual funds, and according to the writers, was never able to form a single association. The 1940 Act, the legislature forced them to get together, and the SEC, there was a dinner after the 40 Act was enacted, because the industry had cooperated in the passage of the Act. There was an SEC industry dinner at which the head of the SEC investment company effort, David Shanker, urged the industry to form an association because I mentioned earlier that the 70 amendments required a lot of SEC rulemaking. The 40 Act would require decades of SEC action, and they wanted an industry group to have a single voice they could work with, and they had worked well on the legislation. So the ICI was created, in a sense, to assist the SEC. And I would say, during most of my time, the relationship has been very good. If it ever was antagonistic, it was kind of on the merits of an issue and not... Well, the industry never had, like a lot of financial industries, had a reflexive anti-regulation attitude. And you go back to the early securities laws, they were opposed by Wall Street, they were opposed by the investment bankers, from New York Stock Exchange, etc. The investment company industry worked to get the 40 Act, get the 40 Act enacted. That has continued. There's probably been less negativism. Now, during my time at the Institute, which is 33 years, it was like a marriage. It was generally good. We had periods where people weren't talking to each other or slamming the door or whatever. But on the whole, it was cooperative.
Who would you talk to? Were there regular channels?
Well, it depends what position I was. When I was, I think early on, probably Dave, when he was general counsel, was speaking to the head of, we did not deal with the chairman or the commissioners much. Most of this was at the level of the Division of Investment Management. And if there's nothing else you get in your history, the person who really made that place was Sidney Mendelson. I don't know if you've heard this, but when I came, there were other division directors, and I thought it was just awful. Every single new idea anybody had, they think was an investment company. It could be this bowl of flowers here. And anything it wanted to do was illegal. It was a very tough... Where that came from, I don't know. But it was in the air. Any new stuff we would regard as totally harmless now, I mean really harmless, was regarded as a felony. Sid Mendelson had joined the SEC and worked in the mailroom, had gone to night college, night law school, was the top enforcement person for mutual funds, and became head of the division in the early 70s. And he just had a common sense view of things. So I've taken you off, but a lot of the reforms we take for granted today, readable prospectuses, performance advertising, et cetera, came out of Sid. He was the guy who drove those. But I'm thinking, I took you off your subject. We would deal mostly with the director of the division. And it was, God, I can't remember all the names, but there were Saul Freeman, Alan Mostoff, Ann Jones, Sid Mendelson, Joel Goldberg. And it was a professional relationship. I would say we probably agreed 70% of the time, disagreed 30%, but it was kind of a...
I did have a question about the innovation. And because this is an industry that's going through a lot of change.
Mm-hmm.
Most of it was coming from the industry through you?
Well, we'd have to list 10 changes and then decide. It's hard to know what change. I don't think there's any perfect. Well, since I'm thinking about writing a book, let me just see if I can take what some of them would be. Money market funds. That was the biggest change. The industry, as we talked about, was say $50 billion or $60 billion in 1968, fell to $30 billion by 74, let's say, to pick a number. And you asked how people were not demoralized, but it was a pretty. It looked like I once said to Dave, or Dave said to me, we ought to take all our papers and give them to Smithsonian. We're going to see that redemptions really work. This industry is going to be. What happened, we learned, was that there's a certain core that's not going to redeem. People have the certificates in their attic or forgot about them. So there was some basis that it was not going to. The whole iceberg was not going to melt. But people in the mid-70s, different people around the country came up with the idea of money market funds. And this was short-term interest rates were 16%. The average person could only use a bank or S&L passbook account, which was limited by law to 5.5% or 5.25%. If you had $100,000, you could buy a bank CD that paid a market interest rate, but if you didn't, you were out of luck. Or you could buy commercial paper, but the average person couldn't do that or buy treasury bills. And a bunch of different people, different around the country about the same time, came up with the idea of a fund that would invest in those instruments, earn 16%, have 1% on expenses, and pay out 15%. And those funds went like gangbusters. So that was people in the industry. There was innovation. Secondly, for obscure reasons now, some of the funds wanted to keep a dollar a share, $1 a share value. The funds go up and down every day based on their portfolio. But some money market funds, because they sold the trust market, needed a constant dollar. They went down to the SEC. The SEC denied that. And you'd have to check with Liebecker. And there was a public hearing at which this one fund group beat the SEC and got the dollar. It was Federated. So there's two instances. The creation and the dollar came from the industry. In fact, the latter over SEC opposition. Then we had efforts in 24 states in the late 70s, early 80s, to outlaw money market funds. Dave and I and the people on our staff were in 24 states in 3 years in these life and death battles. But the SEC wasn't involved in that.
Were the banks fine?
Banks and S&Ls. Country banks, S&Ls, across this great nation.
And the banks
wanted
you to buy
CDs. They wanted you to, have you 5% passbook account, and they lend it out at 16%. It's a pretty good deal. And so we had that. So that was, I'm sort of trying to answer the question, was that the SEC or not? Now, on the other hand, over time, the rule that let you stay at a dollar, you had to meet 100 or 10 different conditions. Over time, the SEC tightened those conditions, sometimes at our urging, sometimes on their own initiative. And those helped assure the safety of money market funds. So I would say that probably was a joint effort by the industry and the ICI. So in money market funds, you get a mixed picture. I don't know what else. Advertising, I gave you an example, mixed, right? The industry's pushing. The SEC came up with this omitting prospectus.
It sounds like...
It was kind of back and forth. I don't think product innovation has to be the industry. But a lot of times it takes a regulatory change to accommodate it.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it's very much of a back and forth.
Well, you touched on the banks.
Yes.
And, you know, that brings to mind the phrase they're trying, I think, unsuccessfully give to the war in Iraq right now, which is the long war.
Right, long war, yeah.
It sounds like you had a long war.
Yes, yes.
I want
Okay. Well, this is kind of interesting. What had happened, I'm going to give you the whole history because this is stuff. From the beginning of the early part of the 20th century, as banks got into securities activities, liberals, reformers, academics thought it was a bad idea. There were hearings in the House in 1913, the Peugeot hearings. Brandeis wrote a book, Other People's Money and How the Bankers Use It, etc. But when the 20s came along, they're just academic ideas that were salted away. Then when the crash happened and the New Deal came in, this became an issue, and they found a number of abuses where banks were in the securities business. So the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 said banks cannot be engaged in underwriting securities. And the whole thing went dormant for 40 years. And then in the early 60s, the controller of the currency named Saxon wanted to give banks greater powers, and not just in the mutual fund area, but in other securities areas, like banks were allowed, Glass-Steagall had an exception for underwriting of municipal bonds. And he wanted to extend that from direct municipals to revenue, whatever, I got me in the wrong words, but they're not, it's not the municipality is liable, it's the revenue stream of the bridge or tunnel. I think they're revenue bonds. I think they're general purpose and revenue. He wanted to extend that. He wanted to give them powers to do commercial paper, and he wanted to give them powers to do mutual funds. So to sponsor, underwrite their own mutual funds.
Why is the control of the currency?
I it's before my time, and I don't know if it was ideological or the banks think they never should have got stuck with Glass-Steagall or they saw more ways to make money. I don't think securities firms had yet entered the bank's turf. So I don't think that had started. This was early, 62, 63. But anyway, they whatever reason, and the mutual fund area, just before I joined the Institute, the controller authorized Citibank to have a fund called a commingled managing agency account. The Institute sued. The thing went up and down in the courts, and the Supreme Court held the Institute won. It was illegal for banks to sponsor and underwrite mutual funds.
The controller is Camp.
Camp, right.
Who? The Supreme Court case.
ICIV Camp. Then a couple of years later, the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System said, which regulates not banks, but bank holding companies, the parent organization of Citicorp, not Citibank, adopted a regulation Y that said this is what banks can and cannot do. Bank holding companies, and they said they could advise closed-end funds. And that led to another Supreme Court decision. ICI sued the Board of Governors that held they could, that banks could advise closed-end funds and by inference mutual funds. So we had this going on in the courts. Same time, there were hearings in Congress going on constantly. From 1978 on, Dave and then I constantly testified at bank powers hearings. Sometimes they were just mutual funds, sometimes they were all powers, sometimes they were different powers. So this thing went on in litigation. It also went on hearings before the banking agencies and in Congress. It was a three-ring circus all going on at once. Congress, the courts, the agencies, with the ICI opposing bank entry into the mutual fund business. And gradually, the banks started to win these court decisions. And by 1980 blank, and I can't give you the year, banks were pretty much coming into the mutual fund business.
The Board of Governors case was, I think,
I don't remember now. Was it?
But, you know, it seems like the Camp is clearly the ICI.
Yes, right, yes.
And then the Board of Governors case, I'm trying to figure out.
Well, I don't know myself. I think what happened is Camp, the controller simply said you can do it and didn't give any reasoning. And the court said, come on, you can't just make up what you want. Board of Governors and the later case, there are a whole series of other cases, the controller and the other regulators spent pages, well, Board of Governors, the Fed did, explaining their rationales. And I think there's this thing of judicial deference toward agencies. I think that happened. There was, God knows, one thing is deference. One, you could, Dagan and I have talked about this at length, the Supreme Court in 71 may have still been, the Depression and the crash may have been closer in their psychic minds. 10 years later, generations change, that kind of thing. I don't really know how it evaporated, but it went piece by piece through the administrative action in the courts. Congress did nothing. So by the time I became president of the Institute in 1990, and this was a very bitter fight. We were suing the banks. We were suing individual banks. You know, we sued a bunch of different banks. A whole bunch of stuff. These weren't the only two cases. There were other cases. Testifying in Congress, going at each other, writing white papers, debating. It was a very angry, in this little world of ours. Boy, you'd have to go back. Well, you're saying that, number one, look what happened last time they were in. Number two, look at the stuff they've done since then. They've had stuff like securities, and they had REITs, Real Estate Investment Trusts, in whatever, the early 70s. Chase Manhattan had one that blew sky high, with a lot of the same kind of problems of self-dealing that the banks had had. We said, you know, bank trust departments now have owned 15% of U.S. stocks. If you give them the mutual industry now 25%, do you really want that? Different arguments at different times. I think there was, putting aside the merits, I think the industry was concerned about bank behavior, tarnishing the whole industry. And also, we were tiny compared to the banks. I think Citibank made more in a year than the whole industry made. And people think the banks would just dominate the industry. It had happened with other industries they had entered. Banks ended up at mortgage banking or whatever, stuff we now assume is banking, that they became dominant. So there was real concern about them taking over the industry. It got murkier and murkier. They won more, but the banks got more and more in the business. And when I became president of the Institute, even though hypothetically, let's say banks ran 10% of the mutual funds in the country, 10% by assets, we only had one bank member. People hated each other. So I went around, I figured we'd lost now. So I went around and spoke to individual bankers, went to Citibank, went to Bank of America, went to Wells Fargo, blah, blah, blah. And this is a funny story. I told my assistant that I'd be asked to give a lot of speeches given I was president of the Institute. I'd have to turn most of them down. But I said, anyone you get from any banks, God, I'll do anything. I'll go to Sheboygan So I went to New York. It's 1991 or two. On a Bank Analysts Federation convention. These are Keith Ruett and Woods. These are people who look at banks, stock picking. And I gave a speech saying banks are great and bankers are wonderful and blah, blah, blah. And I went down to the speaker's lounge. I had an hour to kill. It was snowing. And I had an appointment an hour later, but I had spent an hour somewhere. So I went down to the speaker's lounge, took off my badge, got a cup of coffee, and an old man came over to me. In my mind's eye, he had a cane and a hearing aid. He probably didn't, but that was my... And he said, I really, very much like your speech. I said, thanks a lot. He said, I was so glad to hear somebody from the ICI give a speech without attacking bankers. I said, thank you. He said, I really got sick and tired of the derogatory and evil and malicious things ICI people say about banks. I said, oh, you must mean my predecessor, Dave Silver. He said, no, I mean that son of a bitch, Matt Fink. So the guy had no idea who I was. So the bank war was a long, but Dave was at his best as a general there. I mean, we were a guerrilla group fighting a very powerful lobby. Testifying, bringing litigation, testifying. I think sometimes they had hearings before the agencies. Yeah, on that. So it was constant.
Where was the SEC on?
SEC was kind of, it was funny. The bank regulators, for the controller, was like a bank lobby group. It was absolutely lobby. The SEC, either correctly or naively, said as long as they register with us, it's fine. So they kind of was tailing on the sidelines. So that's all they ever cared about.
Yeah.
That was, maybe that's
the... Ultimately, the banks didn't have to register.
They did, but we have seen since then that peculiar bank problems have happened. And, you know, you got a good question. What does it mean, you know? If you look at these recent market timing, late trading scandals, I think people would agree the worst was Bank of America. And there, this hedge fund approached them. We'd like to trade one of your mutual funds. And a deal was cut where Bank of America lent them the money to do it. So the bank financed this rape of one of its own funds. Now, whether the SEC looks for that kind of thing, you know, that's what nobody quite knows. But so.
Well, you started out by talking about culture.
Yeah.
You know, and,
yeah.
And this,
yeah.
Maybe slightly patrician.
Right. It was very much so. Boston Brahmin. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I think it was, yes. It may not have been common in other parts of the mutual fund industry, too. But the money managers, not just in Boston, but if you took T. Rowe in Baltimore, Dodge & Cox in San Francisco, the top-line investment counseling firms also had that kind of, I'll use the word patrician, noblesse oblige, kind of attitude. We're not salesmen, we're money managers.
So regulation,
why? That's the Board of Governors case. That's right, yes.
And essentially that regulation is saying...
It's saying that bank holding companies can advise closed-end funds, but therefore they could advise mutual funds. So what happened is banks would find a third party, you, would start a... Please start a mutual fund. We'll be the advisor. So you would start it. They couldn't sell it, but they'd hire a third group to sell it. So they'd be the advisor... It was all a sham. It was like hiring a medallion. I mean, they could, and like the people set up businesses to be the sham sponsor underwriters. There were whole BISIS and a whole bunch of people set up businesses just to accommodate banks. Banks couldn't, they weren't allowed to drive after 12, so they got somebody else to, but they were still their car. It was a little bit like that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess Glass-Steagall kind of went away slowly.
Went away slowly for us, yes. It was piecemeal, yeah. Yes.
How did their victory alter the mutual fund industry in general?
I don't know how much it did. At the Institute, another character, if the Institute was more pro-regulation or whatever term we want to use, more cooperative with government, another characteristic was from the beginning was there should only be one association and everybody should be in the tent. If you look at other industries, the bankers, the insurance industry, the brokers, they all have multiple trade associations. Big banks, little banks, life insurance companies, casualty companies, mutual insurance companies. In the brokerage area, you have the SIA, the Bond Market Association, the NASD. This industry only, and so one thing that Algenbeck, Silver, and I always tried to do was keep everybody in. You were much better off fighting in our boardroom than spending time lobbing shells at each other. Because a lot of these industries, half the time, the rival trade groups just fight each other all the time.
Well,
right.
Lyndon Johnson talked about this.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. And if you get an association for left-handed mutual funds and one for right-handed, spend half the time sending the other guys screwing up, telling your members we're much better.
Were you afraid the banks were going to send
And efforts were made. The bankers, the American Bankers Association... formed a subsidiary or an affiliate for bank securities activities, and over to other people, somebody else set up the Bank Marketing Association. So different groups were set up, so we were concerned about that. Yeah, didn't want, and also another reason. So I spent a lot of my early years, frankly, going out and recruiting banks into membership. And a number of bankers joined our board. Chase was on our board, Citibank, Morgan, pretty early. Wells Fargo, Bank of America, I think. Yes.
What could you offer them?
I just would go to them and say, you know, you're better with this industry. Fund industry started as these Boston single, but over the years the insurance industry entered in the late 60s. The brokers didn't have mutual funds till the early 70s. Merrill Lynch, Hutton, they did not have mutual funds till then. And I said, just what I said, that we're all better in one tent working together than creating. Do you mind? Oh, sorry.
Why get a new table when yours?
Yeah, I'd have to build the whole structure. And it also, more minor than that, as the final Glass-Steagall legislation was going through, one had to come up with provisions dealing with particular bank issues.
Is this Graham Leach Bliley?
Graham Leach Bliley. a whole bunch of questions. For example, could the bank fund have the same name as the bank? Could the bank lend to its own fund? None of which I remember what the answers were, but there were a bunch of second-tier issues like that. And I very much wanted bankers on our board as well as securities firms so we could bargain it out. And that's what happened. I had a committee, I can't remember details of this, which had like three bank guys and three non-bank guys. And we had to go through these 10 provisions and figure out what position the ICI would take. Couldn't have done that if they'd been in separate organizations or as easily. Say the same thing, by the way, I was there for the banks. Same thing happened when the insurance industry came in. It's before my time, in the late 60s. But there were similar fights and kissing makes ups or whatever you call it. Yeah.
Money market funds. We were talking about those.
Yeah.
And the Fed. There was a point where there was a threat that the money markets were going to have to carry reserves. Like their checking accounts.
Yes. What happened was... Yes, this relates, I kind of ran through it quickly before. As money market funds came in, paying 15%, banks could only pay 5%. First, my recollection is Volcker, chairman of the Fed, wanted standby authority to put reserves on money market funds. And I think we defeated that in Congress. And that's when the banks and SNLs went to the states, because my recollection is most of those 24 state bills reserve requirement bills. I think that was the device they were using.
The reserves would have killed the money market.
Well, they certainly would have hurt. My recollection is not good. They would have. You would have had to have like 3% sterile, and they were being put. I learned a lot about banking in those years. Regular bank accounts do not require a bank to put reserves. It's only on what they call transaction accounts. I mean checking accounts. So savings. And mutual funds, money markets did not show the characteristics of checking accounts. They had check writing, but people very rarely drew checks on them. They really looked more like savings. And every Fed study showed that. So it seemed wrong on the merits. It also would cut the yield. And the problem we all, and the banks were urging it not out of monetary policy. The banks were doing it to kind of cripple them. And the other problem we hit in the states is, what if the state of Missouri said you have to post reserves? It would cut the yield to everybody around the country. Because they're going to 3% of what you sold in Missouri would now reserve. May only be a tenth of a 1% of the fund, but how could the fund manager, as a fiduciary, for his shareholders in 49 other states, still sell in Missouri? Because to sell in Missouri would be to invoke this penalty. So it had the state thing raised particular issues. Yeah.
And Volcker, you said that the Fed.
Yeah, the Fed. Volcker wanted standby authority.
Even though the Fed study said that.
Yes. You got it. The Fed. Different Fed Reserve banks around the country, Minnesota, Minneapolis, Atlanta, I can't remember who now, had done studies that said these are like, but Volcker wanted it. And we never really got, maybe Dave remembers, I don't remember why, but.
So, out to the states, and this was what, a 3-year process?
At least, yeah.
We're getting up toward the 1980 amendments.
What were they?
That thing called 12B1.
Oh, that wasn't legislative. That's regulatory. Okay, got it. Yep. Yeah.
And I guess my assumption would be that there must have been some people thinking, how do we take care of this net redemption problem? How do we?
Yes. Oh, here's this is again, got to be very careful on this, as you probably know much better than I do, on this historical reinventing history as you look back, not intentionally, but. I think what happened was a couple of disparate things came together. The industry was in net redemptions for 10 or whatever years, right? And the Investment Company Act treated each fund as a separate company with its own board. So some people, Dave Silver, John Hare, I mentioned was one of the, said, gee, why, if a fund is going down the drain, why couldn't directors in their business judgment say, let's spend $50,000 on an ad in the Wall Street Journal tomorrow to get more people in the fund? Because otherwise, it's hurting shareholders. The fund gets smaller, the expenses go up percentage-wise. That was one strand. Why not let the directors spend money? Another strand, believe it or not, was Vanguard. And what happened there was there was an old line fund group formed in 1928 or 29 in Philadelphia called Wellington. Looked like every other fund group had an outside advisor called Wellington and had the Wellington Fund. Jack Bogle joined it, and they had bad performance, and they merged with a group in Boston called Thorndike, Payne & Lewis. And at some point, there was a big fight, and they threw Bogle out. And he got the idea, he was head of Wellington Management, the advisor, and they threw him out. He got the idea of reseizing control, by having the fund directors rise up. So the Wellington Fund's directors, Wellington and its sister funds, took control, formed an advisor that was wholly owned by the funds, and got rid of Wellington. That's how Vanguard structured. You've got 10 funds up here, they own this advisor. Yeah, one board. One board for all, whatever number, 5 funds, 10 funds, whatever the hell it was. And the funds own their own manager. The only way the manager can distribute, it doesn't have any money. All its money comes from the funds. So Vanguard had to go to the SEC, because the SEC said you cannot spend fund money for distribution. Remember, the industry wanted it as a desperation move. Vanguard needed it, because they had no other money. The only source of money were the funds. So they had to get an order from the SEC allowing Vanguard funds to pay for distribution, which is 12b-1.
No kidding.
Yeah. So oddly enough, even though Bogle and others are always attacking 12b-1, the original 12b-1 didn't have that name. But 12b-1 is a rule that lets funds pay for their own distribution. The original one came out of Vanguard. Vanguard had to go to the SEC to get an exemption order allowing the 5 or 10, wherever they were, Vanguard funds to give money to the advisor to use to run ads or whatever.
It's a no-load fund.
That's right, not sold by brokers. Exactly. And that, all the net redemptions, Vanguard, some other things I'm probably forgetting, led the SEC to adopt Rule 12b-1. Which said if directors make a bunch of findings, blah, 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 the fund can spend money on distribution. That's how it all started. In that mix, Dave may have a better recollection than I do, but it was in that mix that it happened.
It seems like over time, 12b-1 turned into
Well, what happened that nobody foresaw, I believe, was people saw it either for the two reasons I gave you. The fund that is going down, the iceberg that's melting, and the directors say, we want to spend $10,000 to run an ad in the Journal tomorrow. Or Vanguard, which couldn't run any ads because it had no money unless the funds gave it money. A guy named Gary Strum was a lawyer in the fund industry, originally at Lord Abbott. Then he went to Hutton, very bright, imaginative guy, and he saw in the insurance annuity business that, this is so complicated, that the variable annuities, where you have an underlying fund and the insurance company owns it, and the variable annuities, that there the funds paid a fee, a mortality and expense fee, part of which paid for marketing. It was mortality because it was insurance product. It was expensive. So he said, gee, here we have a product that's regulated by the SEC as a kind of mutual fund that is paying salesmen. And these things were sold, apparently. You bought an annuity. The insurance company paid the salesman 4%. You bought $100,000. They paid him $4,000. And over time, the fund paid back the advisor for that 4%. So Strum said, yeah, I can do that with 12b-1. We all said, you're out of your mind. That's not why it's there. It's there for the fund going down or for the event. You know, it's not there to pay salesmen. He said, why not? The rule says fund can pay for distribution. And Gary Strum got it through the SEC and the states and God knows where else. And that's the change. Now, 90% of the 12b-1 plans today are you go by Oppenheimer Class B shares. You buy $1,000 worth, you pay $1,000. They pay $40. Oppenheimer pays $40 to the salesman. And every year, the fund pays off that $40. Money comes out of the fund to pay for all those. That's how 12b-1 works. It's become kind of installment paying for the commission. Instead of paying a 4% commission in the beginning, money's coming out of the fund.
How long after 1980?
I cannot do. I wish I knew the answer. I don't know. I think much sooner, but I don't know. I don't know.
Because I know folks at the SEC are kind of two minds.
Oh, yeah. No, the thing, I'm too close to it to know. I don't know. It was not, but three-quarters of the, this is not to justify it, but 90% or three-quarters of the rules and statutes we have are now being used for something that nobody ever thought of at the time. I mean, what's true of nobody ever thought about flag burning when they wrote the First Amendment. Whatever example you want to use, funny animals, you know, they're like, it always reminded me of seashells where a different animal at the sea goes into the, you know,
moving
else's shell. Yeah, and that, it probably happens in every single area we're thinking about.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's just people being creative and finding ways.
Exactly. People trying to come out with a product and trying to figure where to pigeonhole it. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I can do it that way, yeah. There's a lot of that.
One more thing similar to that.
Yeah.
The issue of fees.
Yeah.
And
right, part of
really
that.
Where that ended up. There was a lot of controversy about whether fees could be fixed, whether fees had to be posted in advance.
I mean sales charges or sales charges?
And this would have been going back into the 70s.
Well, it's a front-end sales charges now. Well, what had happened is when the Investment Company Act was passed, a provision was put in Section 22D, which was very unusual, and everybody's bet is that it was put in as part of the industry growing along with the act that let the funds fix what the deal brokers would sell at. So I'm Oppenheimer Fund, I'm selling through 50 different brokerage firms, and I tell all of them it's 4% or 6%, whatever. And that Merrill Lynch, Schwab, everybody has to sell at 6%. It's price maintenance, which is unusual, but it's upheld by statute here. That's what. And there's been another. This is like every other one of these debates. There's been like a 70-year debate on whether that's a good thing or not.
So is that still there?
Yes. Yep. Now, what they can do, the SEC, again, when it liberalized the advertising rules, this was all coming out of your net redemption issue. The industry's going down the drain. It relates to everything. Advertising 12b-1 and this. The industry's going down the drain. And the SEC, I always thought it was because the SEC had done so many wacko things. But plus, it's the market. I mean, it's unclear. But the SEC probably didn't want to lose the horse it was riding. So it says, you can advertise. Or you can use 12b-1. And now it says, so they liberalized 22D. It's not one price in your prospectus. You can have prices based on how much you buy. You know, you and your wife can combine your purchases, get volume discounts over time. So it actually is not one. I think in 1940 it might have been one price. It's a series of prices. And over time, it gets periodically raised. Should that be scrapped and just have the broker sell what price the brokerage firm wants it at.
Perennial question.
Perennial.
Okay. Well, you've spent a good bit of time then sitting in front of Congress.
Yeah.
How about the lobbying arm? How did that develop over time?
Yeah, when I came in 71, and from what I can tell, in 1940, the Investment Company Act, the industry, maybe I'm wrong, was up there itself. Now, maybe they had lobbyists I don't know about. This is before the Institute. In the 70 amendments to the Investment Company Act, it was mostly the Institute, though they did have, I know they had a fellow named Ramsey Potts, and Shaw Pittman was an outside lobbyist. So when I came, we had no lobbyists on our staff. Whenever we needed a lobbyist, we would go outside.
To the industry?
No, to lobbying firms, to law firms or lobbying firms, and used a variety of different people. At some point, and I can't do the year for you, but I'm going to say 1983, Dave Silver was president, I was general counsel. Dave said to me, we need a lobbyist. We got too much or it's too complicated or whatever. So I hired Julie Dominic. And we created eventually a lobbying department, and we had four or five internal lobbyists, as the Institute has now, I guess. Plus, we would hire outside lobbying firms. And as the industry got bigger, that just became part of it. We first were amateur, you know, kind of almost prided ourselves on being amateurs. Similarly, we were probably the last trade association in Washington to have a political action committee. And I remember Eddie Cohen called me up, our outside tax counsel I mentioned earlier, and I cannot give you the year, but he said, had I read the recent tax bill that had nothing to do about, that had nothing to do about mutual funds? I said, no, I hadn't, Eddie. And he said, well, I want you to read subparagraph 8923 on accelerated depreciation for livestock buildings. I said, okay. So I'm sitting there reading it. He's on the phone. He said, look at paragraph. It says, for purposes of blah, 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 chicken coops will be deemed livestock pens. And I said, what's the relevance of that? He said, that's because the Delmarva Poultry Association had raised, at that time, $30,000 for members of the Ways and Means Committee, so chicken coops are treated as cow pens. Said, you're the last priest from town. You cannot do business anymore without a pack. So we were like the last people to come to that. Yeah, probably. Probably, right.
And, of course, you're representing an industry that's growing by leaps and bounds.
Well, I think part of it, and you know this intellectually, but it's very hard when you're there. You know you've grown leaps and bounds. You know you're no longer a cottage industry, you're a player. You know you're no longer a player, you're the player. We're bigger than the banks, bigger than the insurance industry, bigger than the brokerage industry. With $9 trillion, every other household, half of the 401k money. You know it intellectually, but you don't really realize it. I mean, it's a funny, because particularly if you're like me, where you grew up inside, it doesn't seem like a sharp break. It seems itty-bitty steps, but it's quite different.
There must have been some point where you realized
it. Yes. I had lunch with a front PR guy the other day. It's funny what made me, and even though when I became president, we were $1.5 trillion, the 91, we're $1.5 trillion. And we used to have marketing committees. I guess they still do. A press committee and a research committee. And they always had what they call a joint winter meeting. And we'd go to Florida or someplace like that and have meetings of all these committees. And I can't give you the year, but 91, 92, we hit $2 trillion. And we had two people from the press. Eric Schoenberg from Money Magazine. Tom Petruno from the L.A. Times. And one or both said, we've made this industry, and we're going to kill this industry, or we can kill this industry. I don't know what they were mad about, but something had got them upset. And I came back, and I said, oh, my goodness, we are now in a different league. We're $2 trillion. We're going to pay the banks for $3 trillion, let's say, then we're going to close on them. And I came back and instituted a bunch of steps to try to deal with the change in circumstances. One is, before that time, we always had a press operation, which mostly spent time going around the country trying to talk the Chattanooga Blade or whatever into writing a story on mutual funds. We had a research department, which did mostly studies of why do younger people like bond funds, or why do Catholics like gold funds or whatever. So they did marketing. And I said, we're going to change these two departments and get them both on policy. We're going to be at war at some point, and we're going to need our press people dealing with Washington issues, and we're going to need our research department doing work on Washington issues. It was a huge change. It was like moving from a civilian economy to a war economy a bit.
Who are you going to be at war against?
Oh, didn't know. didn't know. But I figured things were going to happen. I'll give you a speech I gave that got into this a bit. I figured, didn't know where it was going to come from. And about that time, I can't do times again. I'll give you a couple of examples of what things that were bubbling. We're replacing the banks. Reserves didn't come up, though I expected it to. There was a 10-year before. I expected it to resurface. We had community reinvestment activists, people want to help the inner city, plus banks who had CRA calling for putting CRA on mutual funds. Why should only banks have to pay, right? Second, Henry Kaufman was the big doom and gloom economist when 15, 20 years ago. Kaufman gave a speech in New York, said mutual funds have replaced banks. Most of these people coming in have no idea what they're doing. They're shareholders. When the market tanks, they're going to panic. There's going to be a run on the funds. The funds are going to have to dump securities. There should be a federal law like we have on bank CDs that if you want to take money out, you have to wait 90 days. So glimmers like that, I can't tell you which came first, the $2 trillion or that, but I didn't know what it was going
to
happen. But I knew
getting big enough
to show up, starting to grow in the 401k area, people's retirement money. Now, I wasn't a genius. I mean, so I said one thing we're doing is we're taking these two departments that are busy telling people they ought to invest, which we need like a hole in the head now. The money's pouring in to turn them into a war machine to get ready. Second thing I did is, and this is a, well, this industry has a lot of shareholders, at least at that time. We had very few employees. You and I can manage $10 trillion or $10 billion. And we were mostly in New York and Boston and L.A. or something. We're not geographic. We didn't have a big political power base. So I looked for everything. And, you know, funds by law have to have independent directors. It's one of the unique things. And I said, we got to get those directors better educated so that they can head off crisis. You know, they'll be smarter, you know, prevent things from happening. So we started a whole director program. So I saw a bunch of, you could see this change that you mentioned, that we were no longer, we used to be a little piece of esoterica. You know, as I mentioned, 75, we tag on our provision on the 75 securities law. And ERISA, we tag on stuff about defined contribution. But we were not a central player. We were a bit player. Now we were going to be one of the big players. And I think what none of us saw is we became the player. Well, you saw it, but you didn't quite know all the implications of it.
Is it the 401k that
you know? You know, I haven't looked at numbers in 2 years. I think it's been a combination. I think 401ks are probably the biggest chunk, but I think people just putting money in generally. I think 401k, if I had to bet 401k, but if 401k didn't appear, we'd still have the problem. Yes.
That was the only good news.
Yes, that changed the world. In fact, when Dave called me today, he said, don't forget this. Again, go back. The industry was only equity funds. From 1940, there were a few bond funds, but not much. Only stocks. One product, one trick pony. Terrific during the 60s. I mean, it goes from $10 billion to $60 billion or whatever, right? Then it goes to $30 billion. It's going like melting. So money market funds came along, and millions and millions, tens of millions of people, like our parents or someone, who never would invest in stocks or bonds or mutual funds. It's so common now, we can't get ourselves in that position. People just use bank, the average American just had a bank passbook, and if she was lucky, now use money market funds. And that introduces them to mutual funds. So you use the T. Rowe Price money market fund, and you get a thing in the mail, gee, we have an international fund or a you know fund that'll grow hair on your head or whatever. It introduced millions of people to the industry, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
probably the biggest single thing that happened was money market funds, yeah.
Okay. In that period of time.
If I was thinking if I write an article, that chapter, I would say the three most important things for growth were money market funds, money market funds, money market funds. I think that's right.
Yeah. But, of course, they're a product of the high
interest. Yes, but they've stayed. There's still a trillion,
okay.
$2 trillion. Of the $9 trillion, $2 trillion is money market funds.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
They don't get the press they used to.
Well, they're pretty uncolorful.
Yeah. Okay. Something else we didn't talk about, and this is a bigger question, and this is why the net redemption? What happened to the industry? Was it just a bubble that burst?
What caused it?
Yeah.
I don't, I'm the wrong guy to ask. Yeah. I don't know. I think basically the market went up in the 60s, or it crashed, but it went down, and was flat during the 70s, I think. Right? Wasn't it flat till 82, stock market?
Yeah.
So, got to explain this. I think every year, year in, year out, 20 to 25% of shareholders redeem. That's a constant. It's like mortality rate. And why does that happen? Because people are sending kids to college, they're retiring, you know, they're buying a house. It usually isn't investor dissatisfaction. It's just that you got 20, 25%. People just take their money out.
I guess I'm wondering if demographics could have something to do with
it. I don't think so. I think this was a constant redemptions. Redemptions didn't spike. This was just the normal, but you had no sales.
Okay.
Why would people put money in equities? God, last year was down 12%. 2 years ago was up 2%. People, I think that's what it was.
Yeah, it's important if redemptions didn't actually go up.
No, I think I'm right. If they went up, it was minuscule.
Okay. I read the ICI characterized, not now, but historically, having been a Democratic lobbying.
Well, I think, I happen to be a Republican. Julie Dominic was our in-house lobbyist for 20 years, and she was a big Democrat. But the staff or the other lobbyists working for her, probably most were Republicans. So I don't quite know what it means.
Okay.
But I'm guessing that's what it means.
I guess most of your friends, most of your contacts are Democrats.
No.
Okay.
Julie's may have been. No. The industry is largely Republican. I'm a Republican. Paul Stevens is a Republican. Dave's a Democrat. I think it's kind of random in the thing. Oh, boy, I haven't done it in so many years.
Yeah, I just want to get a sense. In the bad old days when there were three of you and you had to lobby,
oh,
what would you do?
Well, that was easier then. Not having been a trained lobbyist and not having a PAC or any political sense, I would have an issue. We'll pick an issue. Go back to ERISA. Gee, this 403B market is all insurance annuities. We have people around the country who would like to also invest in mutual funds, have the same protections. Why not do it? So I'd go up on the merits. One thing I learned from Dave and Bob, and this is so obvious, you know, most smart things are, you know, take the racket back, keep your eye on the ball. The stuff is not rocket science, is never overstate your case and always give the other person's case. And I always did that. But I would simply go up on the merits. I mean, I don't know how I got appointments in those days. Now you have to get under Jack Abramoff or something. But I probably would just call up the office, or we had an outside lobbyist maybe would do it, and I would go up and talk usually to the staffs. I would say 98% of the time you were talking to Senator Williams' staff, Congressman X's staff, you know, they're the people working on stuff. And I probably met 30 senators in my life and 100 congressmen, but my stuff was mostly on the merits. You did not have political fundraisers. You didn't have PACs. It was we were a different industry. I don't know if the times were different or we were a different industry. We were such a tiny little part of the world. Yes, it's become a business. We have, you'd have to check with the ICI, we probably have 5 or 6 lobbyists now. We do fundraisers. We have a political action committee. Our members have political action committees. All that kind of stuff.
I'm looking at some of, and moving into more research, I'm looking at some more of the innovations.
Sure.
About variable annuities.
Right.
And that
was in the 60s, I guess.
Yeah.
Before me, yeah.
And you talked about how that kind of led into the IRAs or the 401k.
Oh, it did. Well, what actually happened in this one peculiar market, the college TIA CREF market, you could fund those with only annuities. We got that open to mutual funds. Other provisions in ERISA, like 404C, which says that if an employer, this is a defined contribution, offers a wide range of investments and the employee can pick, the employer is not responsible for the employee's picks. What happens? You know, you worry about employer liability. So this is a way out. I helped write that section, and then we sent in proposed regulations that said if you have a bond fund and a money market fund and a stock fund, you've met that, which kind of does it. So that, am I answering your question?
Yeah.
It's just one of ERISA kind of laid, that kind of thing laid the groundwork.
And that becomes very important with the 401Ks.
Now, yes. Now, 401Ks, we had nothing to do with. Nobody had anything to do with. If I remember the 401K history, Congress never created it. And I'm going to make this up now because I don't fully know it. But Congress enacts in 1978 a statute having nothing to do with pensions. That I think for cafeteria plans. Said that History Associates, is that what your group is called? History Associates can have a plan which provides employees with fringe benefits, and you can choose the fringe benefit. You can. We give maternity leave. We give sick care. We give disability. We give better. And some lawyer nobody ever heard of writes in, a guy named Ted Benna, B-E-N-N-A, writes to the IRS, can I use this for a retirement plan? They say, yes, fine. And that's how 401K got. I believe that's what happened. So the ability of an employer to tell his employee, reduce my salary by 10 grand and invest it. And then somehow the fund industry saw this and went in and sold employers to use their funds.
Yeah.
But I don't really know how all that happened, frankly.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, here's a case.
I think I'm right. I got to know this when I write my book, but I think I'm right. I don't think it was. Yes. There are a lot of cases like that.
Well, we were talking about how, you know, an enterprising business man
yes.
had to find a way,
right.
a way to use a vehicle.
Exactly.
To find a vehicle.
Exactly. Now, again, different fund groups innovate differently. But just to use an example, Fidelity, I think, has been the most innovative fund group. Part of the reason is Ned Johnson, even though he's worth, you know, $17 zillion, always is trying something new and different. And he basically owns the company. So he doesn't. So probably what he does, I imagine, he probably tries 30 new things a year. 27 are complete strikeouts. Two are mediocre, and one will pay for the. I think that's what goes on.
Not everybody could do that.
So we don't know about the. We don't know at Fidelity how many of them died on the operating table. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Could have been he tried 80 things the year four, or 10 things the year 401k happened, and 401k hit. Now, I don't know the answer to that. But
that's interesting. I mean,
yeah.
That would suggest that it's the big players who do the innovating.
Couple of things. It's the industry is now, when I started, when the Institute started in 40, 98% of the industry, of the managers, companies, were small partnerships or family-owned, right? That's what they were, small. They've gotten bigger, but the big change that happened in the late 60s, the insurance industry came in. So today, 15% of funds are run by insurance companies. The brokers came in the 70s. Today, 15% of the industry is run by Merrill Lynch, whatever. Then the banks came in. Today, 15% of the industry is banks. Foreign firms came in. Zurich Financial, whatever the hell the names of these different people are, right? So today, if you look at the industry, I'm making these up. 50% of the assets are managed not by fund-only firms, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, Putnam. Even Putnam's owned by somebody else, but by conglomerates. And my impression is that the innovation happens at the privately owned ones. That's probably a better indicator than big.
Interesting.
A lot of small ones. Money market funds were started by two guys on a shoestring. And there's probably still stuff like that going on. So I don't think size is the... I'm the wrong guy to ask, because I'm a Washington guy. But my sense is it's not... Maybe size is important, but I think a bigger factor is what is the culture of the place. If you're a subsidiary of some huge bank, nobody even knows about you, and you can come up with the greatest idea ever. That's not what they're trying to do. I think.
Right. Well, here's a great idea. Yeah. It did start in Washington. Yeah. Which is ICI Mutual Insurance.
Yes. Now, that was purely Dave.
Yeah.
That was.
What was the problem?
This is very interesting. What happened is every funds under the Investment Company Act are required to carry what's called fidelity insurance. That's against larceny and embezzlement. In addition, as a matter of business practice, they carry two other kinds of insurance, directors and officers, in case your director gets sued, and errors and omissions. And that's if you make a mistake and you're going to get sued. Those are combined into one policy, usually D&O, E&O. And every year, we would do a survey of how many claims mutual funds made and how many premiums they paid. And we found very few claims and premiums going up all the time. And we hired an insurance broker to advise us. And I went, and Dave sent me to London. I went to Lloyd's. And what we found out was that we were lumped, all insurance at that time at least ended up at Lloyd's, wherever the hell it was written. And in Lloyd's, they simply lumped all U.S. financial institutions into one pool. So there was one pool for U.S. banks, mutual funds, insurance companies, brokers, commodity dealers, hedge funds, whatever, who was around in those days. And the S&Ls and brokers were always in trouble. So they were always getting car accidents. And we were paying for their car accidents. So we said, can't you create a separate pool? And they said, no, you're too small. And by the way, we create a separate pool, your rates will go down. We have no incentive to create a separate pool for you. So I came back to Dave and said, look, you know, it's hopeless. And we had a list of possibilities. And one possibility was creating a captive insurance company owned by the insurers. Now, Dave is way ahead of me on this one, but we learned most captives are phonies. They look like they're captives. There's an insurance company for every historical writing group in the country, get a great deal. Turns out it really is Geico, and they're creating a policy for you and they're giving you a 10% discount. But it turns out it's not real. You know, it's whatever you call it. And we said, no, we don't want that. And so we had, Dave said, okay, we'll create our own captive. Our insurance broker almost vomited. It's the last thing they want to hear. You know, it's women's lib or whatever the thing is, you know. And it's very hard to do because you have to raise so much capital, so much commitments. And every insurance company in the country did everything they could to kill us. AIG, Chubb, I can't remember, AIG, did everything they could to kill us, kill the project. And all of our members who were affiliated with insurance companies, their parents said, no way, you're not going to let you join. And Dave went around the country pretty single-handedly. I mean, I think I kind of ran the office for a year, whatever it was, as Dave was going around to create this captive insurance company. Meanwhile, what I knew more about, so Dave knew the business. Dave's way ahead of me, not to be falsely modest, but the other thing that happened was, as the lawyer, I was in charge of what the insurance policies look like. And they would not even write a separate mutual fund policy. They used what they called the broker-dealer blanket bond or something. It was written for brokerage firms. And it was like having on your car a maritime policy. Stuff you didn't need, it would say on your car, if you're ever shipwrecked, you'll get double, right? Well, not going to happen with a car. And stuff you did need, it didn't cover. Because on boats, there's no such thing as a flat tire. So the policies made absolutely, they were gibberish. It really was like a maritime policy or vice versa. It was wacko, and they would not do a separate policy. So Dave creates ICI Mutual by the skin of our teeth, raises enough capital, and ICI Mutual creates its own policy, which fits. Flat tire, whatever, rear-end accident, the thing fits. And the insurance industries, all they do is go out and Xerox it, put their name on it, and cut a rate 20% below it or something like that. But ICI Mutual was a huge... Remember before you asked me about Dave's traits, and I said morality, intellectual strength, and I said something about outside the box and tenacity? This one was mostly tenacity, I would say. I think if you or I, most of us, we would have seen London's not going to help us, got these phony captives, create our own. That's like saying, oh, well, yeah, I'll build a rocket ship in my backyard. Yeah, I can always do that. Anyway, you know, it seemed kind of... It took tremendous stick-to-itiveness to do it.
And he had to essentially convince the industry to buy
it. You got it. Yeah.
Were various sectors easier than others?
You know,
I can take up with
Yeah, Dave, I'm not dodging it. I do not know.
Okay.
I know the companies that were affiliated with insurance companies were, because they were not happy with it.
They were probably real surprised to hear about that.
And I think a lot of other places that had, you know, oftentimes, I don't even know, the internal person who buys insurance at XYZ bank or insurance, wherever, is buddies with the insurance agent. So you get all kinds. There's probably a million cross currents. No, yeah.
Well, moving up into the early
2000s,
we're getting up, and you know, the history books for a while at least are going to see this at just like the 1850s. You know, it's about the Civil War. We're leading up to something.
Oh, okay. What are we leading up to?
Yeah,
the late trading market timing.
Yeah, you know, you can't help it.
Oh yeah, sure. Sure.
The 90s were good. Your industry's growing like mad.
Yeah.
You got another bear market.
Right.
Significant one for quite some time, right?
Was that a worse bear market than we had in? I don't know.
1991.
See, I don't think it was that worse. Yeah.
Yeah. But at any rate.
I was kind of blasé on that kind of thing, but maybe I'm wrong. Yeah.
I guess.
It was mostly a bear market in the tech, with NASDAQ and tech. It wasn't. I mean, I know because the funds I'm in didn't seem to make any difference.
Okay.
They never did well in good times, and they didn't do badly in bad times. I mean, the kind of funds I'm in are.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think the question is, I've read in several places that there were indications, what with trading in the Japanese stock market.
Right. Yes.
Indications that market timing.
Yeah. Can we take one break while I get a cigarette?
Absolutely.
You sure you got 2 minutes for me to stand outside with a cigarette?
Of course.
You sure?
When things happen, you just simply cannot help but look at them.
Retrospectively. Yes.
So I understand, at any rate, that the SEC at some point and the mutual fund industry, you know, the ICI, had some sense of this.
Oh, we knew a tremendous. First of all, since funds were created, there's been market timing, but not of what were the evil market timing. There are people out there who thought that they, by phases of the moon or stock market movements, could guess which way the market was going. And those people traded mutual funds. They were services. A guy named Florian, I'm getting his name right, 30 years ago.
Speculating
in mutual funds. And everybody thought good luck to them, you know. And they were not very good, as I remember. Fabian. F-A-B-I-A-N. Then people start international funds. And you're aware of the problem that the funds compute their price at 4 o'clock. They use the closing prices on the New York Stock Exchange and the over-the-counter market. And they use the closing of the Asian markets. So Japan closes at 4 in Japan. It's 9 in the morning here. You get a price on Sony. 4 o'clock in New York, they take the 9 o'clock Japanese price, use it. There are people, intervening events can happen. There's an earthquake in Tokyo, whatever, currency changes. So people start timing these funds like mad, particularly in tax-exempt accounts, so 401k plans. IBM, I heard, or some one company like that, had people all around the world, so they're very aware of these fluctuations.
Why is it intact?
Because there's no friction when you move. You move from the bond fund to the equity fund. You have no capital gains. So it was probably all over, but taxing up frictionless. You have your 401k plan at historical associates, your brother-in-law's in Tokyo, you're on the phone every day. Says, my goodness, we just had an earthquake. Tokyo's the Sony's down, going to open down 40 points tomorrow. You say, geez, I'll sell my international fund today because I'll get the old price. So it happens. You do it in individual accounts too, but tax exempt were the perfect place to do it. 401ks, variable annuities. It's not detected. There's no tax consequence to you. So you have a million trades. Secondly, you're right. A lot of it's non-detectable because the funds don't know who's in their 401k plans. They just know they got the IBM 401k plan with $800 million in it. They don't know about the individual. So it's going on like mad, and the funds, a lot of funds, are trying to kill it because they hurt shareholders. So people move to other procedures. They start fair valuing more. Instead of using the old Japanese price, they estimate, you know, what they think their 4 o'clock price is. They put limits. You can only do 3 in and out a year. And they say, these are not working. We've got to get better tools. So we have a committee, Craig Tyler, our general counsel, is down at the SEC asking for more tools. For example, we say, because people are switching, they have a money market fund and the international fund, they go back and forth. We say, for example, you should be able to delay that. You ought to be able to take you out of the money fund today, but you won't go into the international fund for 2 days. So to break the arbitrage. The SEC says, no, got a daily redeemability. So we're down at the SEC seeking more tools. The SEC is resisting. Meanwhile, professors are putting out papers. A guy named Zitzewitz writes a paper that this is a huge mess. People, there's a lot of arbitrage going on, and it's costing shareholders, I think he estimated, $5 billion a year. And we looked at it and said, gee, $5 billion's high, but it's probably $2 or $3 billion. So we're concerned about it. What none of us knew, so we knew huge market timing going on, arbitrage of international funds, particularly in tax-exempt accounts where, A, there's no tax friction, B, you have no idea that it's Ken doing it. Unknown to us, and this is how it relates personally, I've been thinking about retiring for a number of years, and the executive committee of our board and I picked to announce my upcoming retirement on September 5th, 2003. It's a Friday. It's a meeting of the executive committee. This is all kept quiet, but we hire a search firm, form a search committee, big press release. 3 weeks before, I go to play tennis a block from here, August 23rd, I believe. And I play with my buddy, and we get done, walking off the court. Who walks on the court next to me but Elliot Spitzer, who I had met once. And we chat. What are you doing down here, Mr. Spitzer? Oh, this is my niece, Judy. How you doing? We kind of knew each other. And as I go out to tennis court, he said, how are mutual funds doing? I said, just fine. He said, just you wait. Have a good weekend. So I come back right in this house. Say to my wife, who's drinking coffee at 10, reading the Saturday Post. And I said, gee, Ellie, you won't believe the goddamnest thing just happened. And she said, you are always exaggerating. You're always worrying. Go take a shower, eat breakfast, relax. So I told my staff on Monday about this, but I thought it was a joke. Week of September 5th begins, Monday, September 1st. I come in the office thinking, gee, I've been here 33 years. I have no idea what I want to do. Hope I have enough money, on and on. I'm going to miss this, but I'm so tired, so much aggravation. Glad I'm retiring. And Wednesday, September 3rd, about 10 o'clock, my secretary comes in my office and said, we just had a very funny call. So what's that, Carol? She said, New York State Attorney General's office called. You ought to turn on CNN or Fox News at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock. Turn it on, and there is Spitzer announcing the Canary proceeding, where he found 4 funds, groups, making deals with market timers. And, you know, my stomach completely gives out. The first thing is, what do we do? And I went down, I had a guy named Tim Ford working for me, one very sharp guy. And I remember because I smoked 3 cigarettes a day or something. Stand out there, and do we say a few bad apples? Or do we say, gee, we're horrified, and we decide, boy, you're crazy to say 4 bad apples. We don't know what's here. So we say we're horrified, we're shocked, we're dismayed. And it turns out more and more of these things come out. Some of them were pretty awful, like the original Bank of America. The bank lends money to Canary to trade, right? Total. Others that come out later are borderline. You or I may have allowed it. I can give you examples, but it gets 20 cases in different degrees. But this is after WorldCom and Enron and the market break, however severe that was. And Spitzer's a terrific publicist. I don't know if you ever remember, he says, this is like betting on a race when you know the results and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Very tremendous. So we're getting clobbered. The media goes ape because for years we had told them, boy, we're an exception to the rule about we're clean, we're honest. We never use squeaky clean, but the squeaky. So they go nuts. The New York Times, the Journal, you know, everybody, Business Week, Forbes. And the stories start to appear. It's all the ICI. He must have known about it, sleeping at the switch, lulled the SEC. It was all baloney. But we're suddenly into it, and one congressional hearing after another. You know, just bing, bang, bang. My concern, and we get some crazy provisions proposed in Congress, having nothing to do with market timing or late trading, they just reach into the grab bag, and all these critics of the industry, Jack Bogle, Mercer Bullard, all had their own pet ideas, so people cobble together a bill with all these wacko ideas. But the thing has life. So our first thing is, hey, we're horrified, people ought to go to jail. And secondly, we tell the SEC, you have to act, and act quickly and decisively. And, you know, so we're urging the SEC on, and luckily Donaldson's a smart guy, and they came out with a bunch of proposals. But it was a whole year of media, Hill, SEC, finger-pointing all over the place. On the ICI Executive Committee, we had 14 people and me, I think. I think five of them get fired because their firms are mixed up in this. So,
how did the rest of the industry react?
Well, the rest of the industry, I think, was spending most of the time wondering what's going to happen to them. That's the first, because nobody quite knew. And a lot of these firms, you know, you could be the president, and you don't know Matt Fink, your top salesman, cut a deal in Sheboygan with the Sheboygan hedge fund.
So
there's a lot of that hesitation. Then some people are calling me up as, we ought to throw these people out of membership. And I said, wait a minute, guys. These are only allegations. Number two, let's assume it's Bank of America and everything they say is right. How would it benefit shareholders of the Bank of America funds for us to throw them out of membership? They won't have any part of the culture or work we do for them. It's shooting the horse, not the rider, or whatever the expression is. So everybody's very upset. The fund directors go up the wall because we never knew about this. How come nobody ever told us? Forbes or Business Week or both of them write articles. The ICI, this all happened because the ICI gave sedatives to the SEC, which is not, we've been urging the SEC to do something about this. Or, you know, we were down there saying, let us break trades, this timing thing. So it was a very tough year.
Why didn't the SEC do the things you wanted to do?
Let them break trades, for example?
Yeah, take your pick.
I don't know. I think, I don't mean this derogatorily, the funds, redeemability has always been regarded, a daily redeemability, as the sine qua non, I can never use Latin, but as the essence of a mutual fund. You want out today, you're getting out today at 4 o'clock. To say, oh, we'll get you, you know, you can get out, but it's going to take a day, kind of flew in the face of that. Now, whether that would have helped or not, I don't know, frankly. Because that tries to take the incentive out of timers. But again, since, you know, the interesting thing about the fund industry is like 70 or 80% of shareholder accounts, the fund doesn't know who they are. 80% of funds are sold by brokers, you know, not no load. T. Rowe Price knows most of its shareholders. But if you're Putnam or Oppenheimer, on the board of Oppenheimer, Merrill Lynch has one huge account. $10 billion account in Oppenheimer Growth Fund. You don't know who the people are. So policing these things would have been very hard. Even if we'd gotten the right to have delayed exchanges. So I'm not finger-pointing at the SEC. I think what we all missed was that funds, we all knew market timing. What we didn't know was that insiders were colluding with it, or doing it themselves. I guess we had two cases. We had Bank of America and other ones like that where they colluded. Canary says, if you let us trade, we'll put more money in your hedge fund or do something for you. Then you had others where the portfolio managers of Putnam are trading. Or PBH, I can't remember the name of that fund group, and small fund group in Philadelphia. Mr. P and Mr. B and Mr. H were trading for their own accounts. So we never occurred to us that there was going to be collusion. Now, afterwards, a number of people told me in the industry that they had been approached by hedge funds, and they turned them down. And they're kicking themselves because we never thought that anybody would agree to it. So a couple of those people said, gee, I wish I'd called you and said I got solicited by this prostitute. I turned her down, but but I didn't know the other guy wouldn't.
So that was tendency to assume the best about the people in the industry.
Yes. or never thought, but we never looked at it. We always worried about people trading individual securities. The fund's buying IBM, you know about it. The fund's going to buy a million shares of IBM next week, you buy IBM. We'd always worry about the fund's investments, people free riding insiders. And we've got a whole series of controls on that. Never thought about fund people trading in fund shares or helping other people trade. Just never thought about it.
So you talk about what you can do. I mean, it sounds like a lot of what you were doing is reacting.
Once it happened, yes. We also, we said put people in jail. We also said the SEC has to adopt tough rules here. So my recollection is vague. But we sent the SEC two pretty tough rule proposals. One requiring redemption fees on people who traded a lot. There'd be, if you, I can't remember the time, 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, imposing penalties, stuff like that. Now, those issues are still being brooded about. But I think what happened, not to belittle what people did, but remember, you got 500 fund groups, say 20 were involved. So it wasn't 480 were not. Secondly, it didn't cost any particular shareholder a lot of money. This was an example. You take 2% out of everybody's account. It didn't. Nobody lost a fortune. It wasn't like Enron or WorldCom. People lost their stake. But it's awful because in a fiduciary business, which this is, it's trust business, any kind of a nickel is... Would it be go to jail? I mean, it's widows and orphans. But also the overreaction by the media and the Hill was unbelievable. That's what really was unbelievable. This Senator Fitzgerald put in a bill in the Senate. It was just amazing. It just scared the bejesus out of me. Yeah. So that was it. Yeah. What I can't tell, and it's a little bit like the 20s. You can't tell were the abuses that bad, or did it just hit at the right moment? You know, you don't know. I still don't know this day. I would say on a scale of 1 to 10, the abuses were about a 6 or 7, but the reaction was a 9.
Yeah, and some of that's just the market for news.
Enron, WorldCom, Spitzer, the Barnum and Bailey of this business. He had learned. I had lunch with somebody the other day. Said, he had kind of stumbled a little bit with the analysts, but he had perfected it by us.
You did get Sarbanes-Oxley. I mean,
that happened before.
Okay, but that did come out of this whole.
That came out of Enron and WorldCom, I think. I think Sarbanes-Oxley was done by the time this happened, but maybe my timing is off.
Yeah, it's
just happened.
One of the questions was one of the people fascinated.
Yeah. Boy, we got less exemptions. We got more. Sarbanes-Oxley is mixed for mutual funds. For example, CEO certification, we got stuck with. So Fidelity, Ned Johnson of Fidelity, has to certify the internal controls, if I'm using the right words, of 300 Fidelity funds. So a lot of it we got. I don't know that. I once knew. It's mixed. If you said Sarbanes-Oxley to most fun people, they would say, my God, we shouldn't have got stuck with it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if we took the 10 provisions. I think most they got stuck. I think, maybe I'm wrong. But
yeah, no, that's something that has been the ongoing criticism,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, people want to ratchet up the independent directors.
So right. I happen to be an independent director, so I have firsthand experience. My fund group has an independent chair who's terrific, but I think it makes no difference at all if it's independent or not. It depends on the person. If you look at the 20 group, if you look at the worst case, Bank of America, they have an independent chair because Glass-Steagall. When banks first came in, didn't let you have bank officers or directors be on the boards of their funds. So when Bank of America started its funds, it had to be an independent. They kept that. And yet it had, I think what most people say is the worst. And I think Fidelity had a study that if you looked at funds with independent directors, with independent chairman, and not, if anything, it proves the funds have the funds that don't have independent chairs. I'm not saying it's the correct study, but the study their study shows actually the funds with management company directors are better. So I don't think to me it's like whether you it's six and one half a dozen. I don't see.
Yeah, if that's the case, why not?
I think it's cosmetic. Oh, I probably would. Yeah, the ICI never went. I think we opposed it, but we never went to war about it. Fidelity's gone to war about it. Chamber of Commerce has brought this lawsuit. But I don't think it makes much difference. First of all, 90% of the agenda of a mutual fund board meeting is dictated by SEC rules. Most of what fund boards do, if you went through the list, first of all, there's certain contracts the board has to approve. The advisory agreement, the underwriting agreement, selling of fund shares, 12B1, transfer agent, custodian. So you have a bunch of service agreements. Then the Investment Company Act is so tough, read technically, it bars a zillion transactions that we might think were somewhere harmless. For example, Oppenheimer Fund A wants to sell 10,000 shares of IBM. Oppenheimer Fund B wants to buy 10,000. You can't. It's illegal to cross that. Stuff like that. Funds take out these ICI mutual insurance policies, right? It's going to insure the fund and the advisor. How do you allocate the dues, the premiums? ICI dues. The group pay money to the ICI. How much should the fund pay? So the directors sit and make those judgments. There's a list. If I showed you the Oppenheimer board thing, there's 40 things, 20 things like that, that take up 90% of the board meeting. Now, that's going to be true whether the guy's a Catholic or a Protestant. It's not going to, or it could be Muslim. He's going to have the same agenda. 90% of it is exactly the same. So people say, well, you know, the chair can dictate the agenda. The agenda is dictated by law, most of it.
Yeah, and there's not a lot of choice, I guess. It's fill in the blanks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're tricky. They're difficult, but there's not. So I always think, to me, it's like having mustard or mayonnaise on a sandwich. I mean, you know, you may have a preference, but I don't think it's funny. It's become the cause celeb. All I'm saying is I don't think if everybody was mandated to have 100% indirect risk, 100% independent chairs, it would make much difference.
I want to touch on one sort of cutting edge thing.
Sure.
And then get to some of the big questions.
Yeah, go ahead. Sure.
Where the industry's going. And, you know, technology is driven so much of this.
Yeah.
While you were still in charge, mm-hmm. what was your concern about web-based mutual fund trading, or basically putting together web-based packages?
You mean portfolio that?
Yeah, web-based.
Well, it looked to us, and we had a law firm look at it, like it was a closet investment company. It looked like a mutual fund, and therefore we thought it would be registered. That was the concern. In fact, Wallman, a lot of his propaganda said this is like an enhanced mutual fund, I think. So that was our concern. Over the years, another thread here, if I can go back, because it relates, that people have come up with a lot of products that don't have the label mutual fund that we think should be treated as mutual fund. I'll give you three examples, just to help you. Citibank manages trust money, and they pool it in a collective trust fund. They're not allowed to advertise it. So if you're lucky enough to have a lot of money, you go to Riggs Bank or PNC Bank with your trust, family trust money, it's going to end up in a pool fund. Fine. They also manage money just as managers, not trust money. Just you go, here's $50,000 or $1 million, whatever. And what Citibank wanted to do in the late 60s was have a fund where they commingled money they managed. We sued, and the Supreme Court said, yeah, that's a mutual fund, illegal under Glass-Steagall. Okay? Citibank thought we were making up stuff, right? Got the insurance industry comes out with a product. It's life insurance, but instead of giving you $1 million at death, your wife, it says this money, the premium you pay, will go into a fund, and when you die, your wife will get what the account's worth. ICI said that's a mutual fund. We won that, a case called Valak in the Supreme Court. So that's two cases. And both of those industries said, you're nuts, you're calling everything, you're calling this flowers a mutual fund, you guys are anti-competitive. Folios was just another example of that. Now, we lost. The SEC came out against us. That was the condition. It wasn't that it was on the web or anything, but we thought when you cut through it, this was just a type of mutual fund. And if we have to register and live with these, with Bob Plays, they ought to register and live with Bob Plays. Yeah.
I just wondered if there's a sense that the technology could change things.
There has, in one area, it, you know, there's something I remember learning in college that mistaking capability for intent or whatever, something like that. Well, for years, like take these managed accounts. These are accounts where you go to a broker, now it used to be with $1 million, now $50,000. And that broker will say, we will give you, you can pick our aggressive or moderate or conservative, and we'll pick stocks for you that fit that. Well, they don't really sit down and look at can. They got a million cans. They look at your income, your age, and there are 50,000 people getting the same stuff. So it looks like, you know, the SEC's adopted a rule letting them out. So people have worried, can that technology get to the point where that's a better way for people to invest? Because they're not regulated. That's a thing people always worry about. But we've been worrying about it ever since I've been around. So the minute the Xerox machine came, somebody said they can Xerox all this.
It's a
matter of tools. I don't know if it ever will. I still believe that mutual funds are by far the best financial product for 98% of Americans. And I haven't seen a better widget yet. But there's always that widget problem. Yeah, yeah.
Well, some of the big questions Business Week said, yeah, the SEC's in the pocket of the FBI.
Right,
RCI.
Right.
You talked about
did you ever see a letter we wrote him?
I didn't.
Oh, I wrote a great letter. Yeah.
No, I missed that.
Boy, it was... Well, one thing is, I can't remember everything. One thing is, we had gone to the SEC, not just on this, but when Paul Stevens was my general counsel, we worried about the industry growing. Remember, I said just one idea he came up with is requiring every fund group to have a compliance officer. Levitt ignored it till the scandals happened, then Donaldson put it on. I discovered shelf space in 94, where fund advisors to get on to sell have to go pay brokers money under the table or on the table, whatever it is, right? I went to the NASD, went to the SEC, begged them to do something about shelf space. They didn't do anything. So Business Week said we were lulling them. Half the time we were kicking them. You know, I gave you three inches, including the money. And another one was Business Week said, and the ICI opposed the self-regulatory organization for mutual funds. We opposed it because we thought it was bad for the consumer. We thought direct SEC regulation was more effective than having a bunch of competitors allegedly regulate themselves. So the Business Week thing really ticked me off, I guess, whatever the word is, yeah.
Well, that's okay. The point I was going to make, I guess, is, and you also talked about Sid Mendelson.
Right.
And, you know, and it's clear that a lot of the initiative is coming from the industry.
Right,
yeah. The SEC is helping make it happen by building it into
the SEC. SEC also starts a lot of things, too. They're not just reactive to us.
I want to get a sense of how you think the ICI has been able to help shape the SEC's approach to this industry over the years.
Boy, it covers so many, covers a zillion topics. I think a lot of time, factual stuff. You know, agencies, they're very cut off from, if the ICI is cut off from the real world, they're cut off. Particularly, one huge mistake made over there, they used to have the inspections for mutual funds in the investment management division. So the regulator had the inspectors. So the inspectors would come back and tell Bob Plays, you were something smells, or Plays would say, go look for X. Now they're in separate silos. There's a whole separate SEC inspection arm. I think that's bad. But one thing is, if nothing else, the ICI provides them with information. How many people have IRIS? You know, how many people are, you know, the SEC says, why can't we do this? Every fund can do something about every shareholder. We say, look, we don't know 80% of our shareholders. And then give them data showing that. So a lot is factual. I'm convinced in my old age that most disputes between people are because they have different sets of facts. That a lot of arguments end when somebody proves, you know, fairly proves. So I think it's back and forth.
How about personalities? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was. Did you ever get that tape where I got interviewed? You probably never did. Did you? Well, I thought of all the government people I met, Mendelsohn.
But you've dealt with a lot of government people.
Yep.
NASD, I
suppose. Yes. Well, less.
Less, but yeah. And certainly Division of Investment Management.
Oh, Investment Management. Well, sure. That was Mendelsohn. Yeah. Well, I would think, you know, they've all had different styles, but. I mean, Mendelsohn has to remain the favorite, but Joel Goldberg, who was his successor, was his junior. Joel was very much like Sid.
If they've all had different styles, yeah. which styles worked and why?
Well, again, you can't tell whether it's the times or the person. I thought taking a practical, non-legal, like, you know, the 33 Act may not let funds advertise performance, but that's bizarre. It's the one thing investors would like to know. How is the fund done? It's commonsensical. You know, we can have prospectuses that are 30 pages that are great for lawyers to read. They're no good for the consumer. Well, you know, the lawyers say, well, you got to put this in, you got to put that in. You know, Sid Mendelsohn, Joel Goldberg kind of people say, well, that's crazy. You know, what good is that? So I think practicality was one thing. If I don't know if that's the right word, but I think the common sense practicality. Yeah. And I was always for toughness. I always thought they ought to be tough regulators, that was good for the industry.
And apparently this gets to an issue I've seen in other places, that the Division of Investment Management was sort of maybe second class over there at the SEC.
I think the SEC, like all, we talked before about the institute's culture, the SEC came out of the 34 Act, which is a broker-dealer culture. And even if mutual funds are 90% of the issues, which not, but whatever, the tendency over there is enforcement and broker dealer. I think it's in the fabric of the place.
You see that in resources. Where else?
I can't. You know, I've been out of it for 2 years, so I just don't know. I'm not dodging. I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, that's sort of a slippery kind of concept, anyway.
Yeah.
Do you think, in general, that the ICI has been has it helped the fund industry change, or has it sort of been a moderating influence, stabilizing influence?
Yes.
You gotta pick one.
I think it's. I know that. I think it's been both. Clearly, we don't come up with products, but. When people have products and new services and they're legal or regulatory impediments, we've helped break those. People want to have no load funds, we help get advertising rules. God, a million cases, you know. I can't even think of the examples are so numerous. But there are also cases where we lead. I mean, we got 403B changed to allow mutual funds in the college professor market. Before people, you know, that's because members said to us, my God, we ought to be in that market. On the other hand, I think it's been very good at spreading culture. It's taken the culture, all these new people coming into business, new people at old firms, new firms. So that's because it's been moderating. It's probably helped people from jumping off a cliff.
Some of them
jumped anyway. Yeah, right, yeah.
Well, is there anything at this point that you absolutely want to bring out?
No. No, you really covered the waterfront.
Well, great.
Yeah.
I appreciate you taking
time. Thank you, sure.